not that the Europeans aren't spending it too enough on defense. It's that the U.S. is pulling back. That the U.S. who founded NATO is reneging on its commitments. And President Trump, every day, every time he talks about NATO, does something to increase those fears.
The role of John Bolton, Joe Cernciani.
John Bolton is a serial arms control killer. He has never believed in arms control, negotiated solutions to weapons. So he's the hidden hand behind President Trump's decision to pull out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty that Ronald Reagan negotiated to pull out, to get rid of nuclear weapons that we were stationing in Europe, what they call the intermediate range nuclear weapons. He never liked the treaty. When it was negotiated, he's in favor of more weapons, not less. And because we're killing the treaty, the U.S., guess what, is now set to build a new ground-launched cruise missile that could be placed in Europe. The nuclear arms race is back in Europe, largely because of John Bolton.
Joe Cernciani, we're going to ask you to stay with us. We're going to do a web exclusive with you at democracynow.org. Joe Cernciani is president of Plowshares Fund, Global Security Foundation, author of Nuclear Nightmares. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 8th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. When their relationship turns sour, a couple undergoes a medical procedure to have each other erased from their memories.
I'm erasing you and I'm happy! You did it to me first! I can't believe you did this to me!
Again, that's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, showing Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory in Portland. Second in a series of community forums on Zenith Energy's Tar Sands Oil Export Expansion, this event will supply project background, climate justice impacts, health and safety risks, and ideas for public action around Zenith's oil terminal. A variety of perspectives will be presented. Again, that's the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory, 6543 North Burlington Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Oregon Symphony's Concert for the Community, Saturday, April 13th, celebrating music from the Americas with music of North, Central, and South America, featuring performance by Hillsborough's Mariachi Una Voz. More information is available at orsymphony.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of people participated in the Oregon Law Enforcement Career Fair in Salem today.
Residents of a Northwest apartment building in Washington, D.C. hold a rally as part of an ongoing rent strike against a negligent landlord.
And in international news, as the March of Return demonstrations entered their second year, the death toll of Palestinians killed by Israeli live fire increases.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 5th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The Oregon Law Enforcement Career Fair is being held in Salem today and tomorrow. The state's Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST, announced this morning that about 500 people participated in the first 2 hours. DPSST Director Eric Gablick said that as around 1,000 Oregon law enforcement officers reach retirement age, agencies are already trying to fill 200 open positions. A projected 300 further positions will need to be filled in the coming year. The Portland Police Bureau announced earlier this week that it was struggling to fill 120 positions. Chief Daniel Outlaw and Assistant Chief Chris Davis told City Council on Tuesday that two of the biggest barriers to filling those positions are failure to pass background checks and the greener grass at other police forces in the state. Davis explained that, for example, of 61 applicants for new unarmed public safety specialist positions, only three have passed background checks so far.
A notice for landlords in Portland: you must register with the City Revenue Division by April 15th. The city adopted a new registration system last July, requiring landlords to record the addresses of all rental units each year. The Census Bureau estimates that Portland has about 127,000 rental units occupied, making up nearly half of all homes in the city. Registration is free for the first year, and landlords may request an extension until October 15th. Failure to register can result in a penalty.
The U.S. Department of Justice released the results of an investigation into Alabama state prisons earlier this week, one of its first such reports under the current administration. A day later, an appeals court in Alabama reversed a lower court's dismissal of a case brought against jail guards by the father of a man who died after his cries for medical help were ignored. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more about these cases that shed light on one of the worst state incarceration systems in the nation.
Perhaps you are aware, but jails and prisons in Alabama have a bad reputation. This week, however, has been unkind to the status quo for incarcerated people in the Deep South state. On the national stage, on Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Justice released a damning report on Alabama's state prisons for men, finding a, quote, pattern or practice of resistance to the full enjoyment of rights protected by the Eighth Amendment, unquote. The Eighth Amendment protects against cruel and unusual punishments, and the DOJ report cites one single week of incidents to give an example of the world created by the Alabama Department of Corrections. During one week in September 2017, while the investigation was ongoing, a sampling of DOC records showed 5 stabbings, 6 severe beatings, 3 major drug busts, 4 reported sexual assaults, and an incident of a guard being threatened with a 7-inch knife. And that's a sampling of what are probably already underreported incidents. 2 inmates died, one from stab wounds and another from a drug overdose in that one week. During these incidents, guards were barely present, with the fatal stabbing having occurred in a so-called hot bay, full of, and guarded by, prisoners. The report also notes 15 suicides in the past 15 months across the state prison system. In all, Alabama state prisoners experience one of the highest rates of murder and rape in the nation. The DOJ notified Alabama state officials that it would sue in 49 days if the state had not satisfactorily addressed the issues raised in the report. 49 days would be May 21st. Less well known is a case that was just decided by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, stemming from a death in custody at Covington County Jail in Alabama. In November of 2013, Almas Taylor was found by a sheriff's deputy after crashing his pickup truck while intoxicated. At the county jail, Taylor died from internal bleeding the next morning. Fellow detainees testified that they heard Almas crying out in pain and for medical assistance all night, with the guards at one point telling him to, quote, shut up, unquote. Taylor's father sued the guards for deliberate indifference that caused his son's death. In the Middle District of Alabama, the case was dismissed due to the defendant's claims of qualified immunity, which essentially means that a government official is immune from prosecution for actions taken in their official capacity, as long as they did not violate any clearly established constitutional standard. Qualified immunity comes up in cases of police brutality and misconduct often, with courts regularly dismissing cases because plaintiffs cannot prove that an officer either violated constitutional standards or did so knowingly. Deliberate indifference to a prisoner's medical needs, according to the 11th Circuit's opinion, is a constitutional violation. When the Middle District of Alabama ruled in the guards' favor, it was partly because the guards said that they were not aware that Taylor was bleeding internally. The 11th Circuit, however, said that it is not required for guards to be aware of a specific ailment, and that ignoring Taylor's cries for help all night long was bad enough. Most cases like this end with the judge granting so-called summary judgment with no trial hearing to the defendants based on their qualified immunity. In this case, however, the 11th Circuit sent the case back to be retried by the district court, a rare, if limited, victory for the relative of a person who died in custody. For KABU Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Congresswoman Charisse Davids presided over Thursday's vote in the House on the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act.
On this vote, the yeas are 263 and the nays are 158, with one answering present. The bill is passed.
After its passage, Congresswoman Deb Haaland spoke outside the Capitol about provisions for Indian Country.
BAWA that we passed today is more inclusive, and there are provisions targeted specifically at getting justice for women in Indian Country and women, Native women in urban areas.
Native women's advocates across the country celebrated its passage, as its fate is unclear in the Senate. News of VAWA's House approval came as community members, students, and advocates held a roundtable discussion in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on a database on missing and murdered Indigenous women. Anita Lucchesi is the creator of the database. She says while legislation is critical to helping address missing and murdered Indigenous people, it goes beyond policy, with much of the work at the grassroots level.
This is an issue that affects everyone, whether you're Native or not, whether you live in a tribal community or in a city, whether you live in a state with any tribes or not. Every state has Native people living in it. Every community has Natives in it. And this is a public safety issue that affects all of us. I think a lot of us don't even realize that, you know, maybe the alley that you drive past on your way to drop your kid off at school is a place where someone was found. And if we start unpacking that and coming together as a community and building those relationships, we'll be able to stop the violence.
The Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute hosted the discussion. Jody Brichet is a reading and writing instructor at the Tribal College.
Including Indigenous voices is so imperative to having this actual discussion, to really knowing who our community leaders are, that it really starts with grassroots membership, along with all these different forms of like leadership, that are people that are coming to the table, people that are making things happen, people that are stepping up and saying, okay, this all these different issues are happening, all these different issues of missing and murdered Indigenous women, it's happening too close to home. People are directly impacted with this, and we need to find some solutions.
State leaders, state lawmakers, and representatives from Congresswoman Haaland's office took part in the roundtable. Navajo leaders are sending condolences to the family of 4-year-old Adine Jones, who went missing nearly 3 weeks ago in the community of Aneth, Utah. A body was found in a creek this week, believed to be the little girl. Search efforts were held by the tribe, volunteers, and law enforcement. The case is being investigated by tribal and federal agencies. Police have arrested a suspect in connection to racist graffiti at a Chickasaw Nation office and Democratic Party headquarters in Oklahoma City. The Associated Press reports 45-year-old Allison Johnson was arrested Thursday. She's also accused of vandalism in Norman. Native women in business are meeting at Isleta Pueblo in New Mexico to support each other and share ideas and resources. The second Native Women's Business Summit kicks off Friday. It's hosted by the group Native Women Lead. Stephanie Poston is a co-founder of the group.
In our families, we are the backbone of our families. A lot of cases, we are the breadwinners in our families. And so how do we come together and talk about that in a safe way? There's so many young women out there doing incredible things. I'm just amazed. Like, how do we continue to support them so they can emerge and become the best that they can be? Because as women in our communities, if we're safe and secure, our children are safe and secure, and that helps our overall community.
300 women are expected to gather for the event. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Vision Maker Media.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on, it's still a question, I'll let you know later. At 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Hard Knock Radio. And at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies this evening, will give way to cloudy skies and rain overnight. There'll be a low of around 45 degrees. And for tomorrow's weather, a steady rain in the morning, showers continuing into the afternoon, with a high for the day of around 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1792, George Washington cast the first presidential veto. In 1955, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill resigned his office. And 25 years ago, in 1994, grunge legend and musician Kurt Cobain committed suicide. The quote of the day is from Kurt Cobain. Quote, "My songs have always been frustrating themes, relationships that I've had. And now that I'm in love, I expect it to be really happy, or at least there won't be half as much anger as there was before." End quote.
And now time for a moment in labor history. The longest major strike in U.S. history began on this day in 1954. Here's more.
Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. It began what some have called the longest major strike in U.S. labor history. The strike was against Kohler, the Wisconsin-based manufacturer of bathroom fixtures. 2 years before the strike, the workers had formed Local 833 as part of the United Auto Workers. They wanted the right to join the union of their choice, improved wages, and recognition of seniority. When the company refused to bargain in good faith, the members voted to strike. On the first day of the strike, 3,000 workers marched around the plant. Few could have imagined when they walked off the job that many of them would not return for 6 years or even longer. The Kohler Company remained unwilling to negotiate. As the days turned to weeks, then into months, sometimes violence broke out between the scabs and the strikers. But what sustained the strikers was the strong sense of solidarity and community they built together. One pamphlet produced by the union had a picture of a baby on the cover. Above the baby was written, "All my life, my daddy's been on strike to make my future better." Finally, in 1960, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that the company had not followed bargaining laws. It ordered the company to let 1,400 striking workers return to work and to pay back wages. Another 6 years would pass before the issue of payment would be resolved. But in the end, the company had to pay $3 million in back pay and another $1.5 million in pension payments. At the 60-year commemoration of the strike, Local 833 President Dave Boscher declared, "I stand here in awe of the sacrifices of these people." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
From Washington, D.C. comes a report talking about tonight a group of tenants in Northwest Columbia Heights, D.C. will hold a rally as part of their ongoing rent strike, which started March 1st. The tenants are protesting the landlord's intentional long-term neglect of the building, saying that Domenico Panza, the owner of the complex, hasn't run routine maintenance on the building in years, in hopes that the uninhabitable living conditions will make tenants want to move out. The tenants of the rent-controlled building are mostly older immigrants and have been exposed to health hazards such as rodents, mold, cockroaches, and electricity shortages during the winter. The report explains that Panza, quote, offered the tenants $15,000 to move out, a lower-than-average buyout that has become more and more appealing as the conditions continue to deteriorate.
Is capitalism to blame for our economic ills and inequalities? Analyst Mark Cuniberti of Money Matters has the answer, and it might surprise you.
Welcome to another edition of Money Matters. My name is Mark Cunaberdy. Much of society's economic ills are laid at the feet of capitalism. In this analyst's opinion, in actuality, most of those ills are because capitalism has been hijacked, distorted, or otherwise thwarted by meddling governments and regulators. Capitalism is nothing more than one person buying what he needs from another at a price agreed by both and without outside interference or mandate. In all systems, there is good and bad, and capitalism is no exception, but the perceived bad in capitalism actually works for the good of the system. It is just not always obvious at the onset. Much like cauterizing a wound to prevent infection, the capitalist process might have its painful and ugly moments, but the reasons are beneficial in the end. The basic result is, if you let capitalism work its magic, and the basic transaction between parties and their free will is preserved, the good of the system is maintained. And isn't that the main theme of America, freedom and liberty? Truth be told, there was little resemblance of the system we have today and true capitalism, hence the bad name capitalism has been given. Subsidies, unions, regulations, the lobby system, protectionism, tariffs, minimum wage, and a host of other interferences and hindrances, in this analyst's opinion, by governments have broken many of the cogs of the self-repairing system of capitalism. It's why we see the problems we do today. Although many blame capitalism for their problems, the arms of capitalism, if allowed to work, would fix most economic ills, but those arms, or at least many of them, have been handcuffed or outright cut off. Capitalism is just basically freedom, the freedom to make a buck, retain it, and do with it what you like. Pretty basic stuff. For that premise comes the beauty of a free market, which, to the chagrin of some, come laissez-faire and trickle-down economics, which actually work if unmolested and unregulated. But then again, we haven't seen that for literally decades. Capitalism addresses excessive profits with competition. Regulators thwart this check and balance of capitalism with excessive regulatory costs, which erect excessive barriers to entry. In other words, it costs too much to start or maintain a business, to compete and bring those other prices down. Proper wages are addressed by a sound dollar policy, which maintains stable and long-lasting power of the paycheck. We haven't seen a sound dollar policy for literally decades. Since wages always lag inflation, when the government maintains an inflationary policy, which is what it does it to fund itself and its programs, and that erodes the buying power of the paycheck. This means workers fall further and further behind. The more inflation and the longer it continues, the further behind workers find themselves. Wage increases always lag general inflation. Conversely, if a deflationary environment was maintained, where prices were allowed to drop, workers would benefit more and more over time. Capitalism would not cause living wage deficits if there were strong dollar policies in effect. Capitalism does have its drawbacks, and when those occur, and only when those occur, should a regulatory body intervene. Monopolistic situations must be mediated by a central government, as well as environmental concerns and workers' concerns, but few other instances of a capitalistic system require intervention, but for the most part, the capitalistic system is the original way the caveman survived. He basically fought and won his daily bounty, and those that did survived and prospered. From there evolved man's concept of free will and the right to possession. Basically, what's yours is yours, and what's theirs is theirs. There's no more basic concept or right than the right of possession. Unfettered with constraints, this system is the oldest and the best. In this analyst's opinion, no other system will work, nor ever has for long. 2 Thessalonians 3.1 says, "If a man will not work, he shall not eat." Now, that seems logical to me and fair, with the exception of compassion on those that truly cannot work. Then another verse comes to mind, Proverbs 22:9. "The generous will themselves be blessed, for they share their food with the poor." I know there'll be some hearing this who will scoff or even despise the biblical reference used here, but few would argue these are wise words, all of them. And that does it for another edition of Your Money Matters. Views and opinions expressed are my opinions only, and they do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its staff, management, or underwriters. I'm a featured columnist in a variety of media outlets. I'm also an investment advisor representative to Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed may not necessarily represent Cambridge's as well. Our website is moneymanagementradio.com, where everything is free.
In a statement made to reporters on his way to the southern border, President Trump says he has not changed his mind about shutting down the border between Mexico and the United States. Here's more.
I never changed my mind at all. I may shut it down at some point, but I'd rather do tariffs So Mexico, I have to say, has been very, very good, you know that, over the last 4 days since I talked about shutting down the border. If they continue that, everything will be fine. If they don't, we're going to tariff their cars at 25% coming into the United States. So every time they make a car, it's a 25% tariff. That means we make money as opposed to lose money. We probably bring those car companies back into the United States. But if, on the other hand, it doesn't work, which it will, 100%, the tariffs will work just like they've worked with steel. Our steel industry is so hot right now because of what I did with tariffs. Same thing with aluminum. They'll work. But if it didn't work, I will close the border. I also am looking at an economic penalty for all of the drugs that are coming in through the southern border and killing our people.
At least 83 Palestinian civilians were wounded when Israeli soldiers fired on them today at a nonviolent protest in eastern Gaza. That's according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. In addition, the Israeli forces stationed at the Gaza-Israel border used a strange new bright red tear gas against demonstrators. Three demonstrators were critically wounded by that live gunfire. It has also been reported that dozens of demonstrators tried to cross the fence, and Israeli soldiers stationed in sniper towers fired live bullets and tear gas canisters directly at the demonstrators. A Palestinian eyewitness says the Israeli army used several tear gas canisters that emitted red smoke, which appeared to be poisonous gas. Several thousand protesters participated in the weekly demonstration. Some protesters lit tires during those events, which is in its 53rd week. A little history here. The Great March of Return began on the 30th of March in 2018, and it demanded the lifting of the Israeli siege imposed more than a decade ago. The weekly protest also calls for the right of return for refugees who were displaced from their homes in what is now Israel 70 years ago. The head of the Hamas Political Bureau, his name is Ismail Haniyeh. He said during his Friday sermon that the Palestinian people will not retreat from the March of Return. He added that the Palestinian cause is not merely humanitarian, it is a matter of national liberation. Haniyeh's statement came after Hamas and Israel reached an understanding, mediated by Israel, to hold a tentative truce after a wave of escalation by Israeli forces over the past month. This escalation included hundreds of airstrikes and the amassing of hundreds of tanks at the Gaza-Israel border.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 5th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jezaniah Hawthorne and Sam Bowman. The producer is Tammy Hobteas, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of evening news and public affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down into the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. And at 11, it's Health Watch. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Have a good night, Linda.
Thank you, Michelle, and good night, Ray.
Good night, ladies.
Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 8th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. When their relationship turns sour, a couple undergoes a medical procedure to have each other erased from their memories.
I'm erasing you and I'm happy! You did it to me first! Believe you did this to me.
Again, that's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, showing Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, for many of us, while we recognize that the priorities and practices of news media affect our lives, news programming isn't where we live, so to speak. It's creative media, dramas, comedies, even cartoons that engage us with their opportunity to stretch imaginations, shift perspectives, and reveal hidden experiences, which contributes to our disenchantment when the same structural problems that plague other U.S. institutions show up